Well, OK, sorry for that. And thank you, Vice-Chancellor, for that kind introduction, and to you, the audience, for coming out on this cold evening. That's too far. OK, for the last 30 years, I've had a problem. I go to parties, I bump into somebody I've never met before, and they ask, what do you do? For some people, the answer is simple. I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, that's sufficient. I mumble, well, I'm a lecturer or a researcher at the university, but I know the next question will be, what do you do research on? Well, over the 30 years, I've tried to prepare the one-minute answer, what is science policy research? But I can see after about 30 seconds, there's too many distractions, loud music, their eyes glaze over, and generally I give up. So tonight, you get the full answer to what do I do? What is the field of science policy research? What have we learnt in the 50 years that it's been going? I will look at some of the contributions that I personally have been involved in and some of the lessons to draw from that, and conclude, as the Vice-Chancellor has indicated, with some big questions like, is the world a better place? In preparing this, I've tried to give some thought to what you're expecting by way of a professorial lecture. You don't want to hear my latest research findings. You want something more by way of synthesis, a bit more accessible, so that even my family who are here tonight for the first time to hear me lecture can understand it. Something more personal, perhaps revealing some of the things that we don't normally talk about. What motivates us? What are the implicit assumptions that underpin our work? So first of all, what is the field? Well, there's a definition: economic policy, management and organisational studies of science, technology and innovation, with a view to providing useful inputs to decision makers concerned with policies for and the management of science, technology and innovation. So straight away you can see the primary focus is on specific policy or management issues. We're not really concerned with theory or puzzles suggested by a paradigm. We don't have a paradigm yet. What we do in our work is essentially multi or interdisciplinary rather than monodisciplinary, carried out in a variety of institutions, not just universities. And over the 50 years the field has been growing, it's grown from about half a dozen researchers in the mid-50s to several thousand people around the world today. To confuse things, the terminology has changed a bit over time. In the 60s, early 70s, it went under the name of things like science policy or research policy or R&D management. In the 80s, technology began to appear in some of the titles. And more recently, people have talked about things like evolutionary economics or innovation studies. A more complete title for our field perhaps would be Science Policy and Innovation Studies, but for this evening, for simplicity, I shall just refer to Science Policy Research. And as you can see, it draws upon a number of cognate social science disciplines, such as policy and political science, economics and management, and is located somewhere in between all these disciplines. Why is this field important? Well, the argument goes science, technology and innovation have been the source of most progress to mankind over the centuries. It's been a major contributor to wealth, producing new goods and services, enabling us to do things we couldn't do before, improving the quality of life generally, but occasionally making things a little bit worse. And in the last 15 or 20 years, globalization and international competition have upped the ante here. Now, there's a growing premium on knowledge and innovation if you're to compete in this globalized economy. So science and technology are increasingly important, and therefore we need the most effective policies that we can come up with. A little bit of background, well, you've heard some of that, natural scientists, early 70s, but beginning to get interested in some of these big questions. What is progress? What is growth for? And so on. I'd read Galbraith at school, and I remember sneaking out of my physics lectures to go and hear Galbraith, who at that time was on sabbatical in Cambridge. I was involved in the science and society discussions, which centred around the issue, is science being used for the full benefit of humanity? So as I ended that period of study, I had a dilemma. Did I continue in physics, or did I switch? And in the end, after 2 years working in NAFRA, I decided to make the switch and went off to Manchester, and began this intellectual journey that took me from natural science via sociology of science into the world of science policy research. The field now, as I say, is about 50 years old. So the question next is, what have we learnt in that period of 50 years? What have been the big developments? And to what extent have those helped us improve policies for science, technology and innovation? There have been various previous attempts to look at this, various review articles and book chapters, but mostly they've been rather subjective. And I've tried instead to adopt a slightly more rigorous approach to identifying the major contributions. And I've come up with a list of 20, which I'm going to take you through very quickly. How have I done this? I've concentrated on high-impact publications from people working in the field. Ideally, I'd like a measure of how much impact their work has had on the world of policy or management. But unfortunately, there isn't one. So instead, I've started with which publications have earned most citations from other researchers in and around the field. And then I've looked at those and come to some conclusion about how much impact I think they've had. There are a number of assumptions built into this, a number of problems. I haven't got time to go into details. I've started with a long list of important authors in the field, a list of the journals in which we tend to publish. With a keyword search, I've gone through that and identified about 200 of the most highly cited papers that have earned 250 or more citations. And from those, I synthesized them down to 20 key things we've learned. The first actually predates the start of science policy as a separate field. Goes back to Schumpeter, one of the very few economists in the first half of the 20th century to pay attention to innovation. He was responsible for the important distinction between invention and innovation. In his early work, he focused more on the role of individual entrepreneurs, but later on, after he'd moved to the States, he focused more on collective R&D as carried out in industrial R&D labs, which he saw around him. So that move from individual entrepreneur to corporate innovators is one thing. A second move has been from a laissez-faire approach to government intervention. Before the Second World War, there was not a lot of government involvement in R&D or innovation, with the exceptions of agriculture and medicine. But all that changed with the Second World War and big projects, not just the Manhattan one, but projects like to develop radar and cryptography. So after the Second World War, a number of Western nations launched major R&D programs in things like defense and space. Underpinning these was a belief in what we've now called the linear model of innovation. Things start off with basic research. The results of that feed into applied research and turn into technological development and in turn into innovation. A simple, clear model. And a very convenient model. You show it to policymakers, and they say, OK, what do I do? And you say, well, you put money into this end of the chain, and then eventually out of the other end of the chain will come contributions to health, wealth, and national security. And this model underpinned policies in the 50s and 60s. Later on, the economists came up with a justification as to why governments should become involved in funding research, technology, and innovation, an argument based on the notion of market failure. In two key early papers, Nelson and Arrow argued that scientific knowledge is what economists would call a public good. It has characteristics of being non-rival and non-excludable. And what that essentially means is that those who invest in R&D, like companies, cannot appropriate all the benefits. Consequence, they do not invest at the socially optimal rate, and therefore governments have to step in with investment in R&D to top things up to the socially optimal level and expand the pool of useful knowledge. In the late 1950s, economists were beginning to realize that economic growth could not be explained just in terms of changes to labor and capital. There was a large residual, and Solow was one of the first to attribute this to technical change. At about the same time, Grillitis was looking at investment in agricultural R&D and showing this produced very large returns. There were other important contributions by a number of economists and economic historians, and the first, as we shall see, of several from Sprue and Chris Freeman, who produced in 1974 the first edition of The Economics of Industrial Innovation, which for several decades was really the only book that spanned the entire breadth of science policy and innovation studies. Next, from single division to multi-divisional efforts, Burns and Stalker produced one of the first books looking at the management of innovation with two major findings. Innovation is influenced by different organizational forms. Secondly, successful innovation requires the integration of research and development with knowledge of the market, something which is often impeded by divisions within the company. And then there were other books on the management of technology and innovation, which I can't go into. I'm having to skip fairly quickly through this so I can get on to the next part. From technology adoption to innovation diffusion, this essentially was coming from sociologists looking at the spread of medical innovations or agricultural innovations. Rogers in 1962 produced the first edition of his book, The Diffusion of Innovations, which, if you add together the citations to all five editions, is one of the most highly cited books in all the social sciences. 8,000 or 9,000 citations. Two things in that. He looked at the diffusion of innovation and showed it often follows an S-curve. Slow diffusion, rapid growth, saturation, levelling off. And also he distinguished different types of innovators, ranging from early adopters through to laggards. Economists then developed some of this model, but again, I must skip on to the next thing. From science push to demand pull. I've mentioned the science push model, which was prevalent early on, but around the 1960s, economists came up with a rival model, the demand pull model, where things start with a changed market demand, which then calls forth innovation. So there is the model, market demand and so on, through to innovation. And you notice straight away, basic research does not feature in that. That model was picked up by one of the big studies shortly afterwards, which claimed to find that demand is more frequently important than recognition of technical potential. So now you have a fight going on. Which is right, science push or demand pull? And clearly these two models have very different policy implications. So during the 1960s and 70s, a lot of big studies went on to try and sort this out. One by the Department of Defense in the US, looking at the origins of military innovations, what critical research events made those possible. And they concluded that 95% of them were linked to a research need, to a military need. Therefore, they concluded demand pull much more important. The scientists weren't too happy with this. The National Science Foundation in the States commissioned a rival study a year later. Same sort of methodology, but looking at civil innovations. Main difference, looking back 100 years rather than 20 years. And lo and behold, if you go back far enough and label the critical research events as either related to non-mission-oriented or mission-oriented, you find 70% of them are non-mission-oriented, so science push, much more important. Other agencies weighed in. The National Institutes of Health looked at innovations in cardiovascular research and found that 62% of the key research underpinning those was basic, and concluded, and I'm not quite sure they got to this, basic research pays off twice as handsomely, something which was set to stand the National Institutes of Health in good stead over the next two decades when asking for more money from Congress. Then our colleagues from Manchester joined in, and they were amongst the first to say, actually, guys, it's a mixture of the two, a mixture of some kind of need with some kind of technical possibility. And things were finally put to bed in this authoritative review article, which says, yes, innovation, an iterative process in which both demand and supply forces are responded to. Next shift, from single factors trying to explain innovation to multi-factors. And this was one of Sprue's most influential studies. And the key thing here was this recognition that all the earlier work had focused on successful innovations. But actually, you needed to contrast successful innovations with less successful ones. And from that, from using match pairs of successful and unsuccessful ones, identify what factors appear to account for success. And that study found most important factor, user needs understood, but a range of other factors, attention to marketing, support of a product champion, good communication with the external scientific community. That report is still being cited today in industry by those engaged in the management of technology and innovation. Okay, so science push and demand pull models are no good. What were they replaced with? The interactive chain link model of Klein and Rosenberg. Somewhat surprisingly, the model that they came up with is rarely reproduced. The reason is it looks like that. It's fearfully complicated. You can spend 2 or 3 minutes reading all these instructions here trying to make out what it says. People generally simplify it a bit, so here's a simplification. And it's clearly a better representation of a complex reality of the innovation process. But you've immediately got a problem. You show that to policymakers or managers, and they say, OK, so what do I do? And there's also an interesting little footnote here. Next 20 years, various science policy researchers have said, we've shown that the linear model is dead. We've slain it. But they always refer to the linear model in the singular, and it's always the science push model. The demand pull model seems to have got written out of our history as if it never existed. It's got airbrushed out. Why that has happened, I don't know. from a static to a dynamic model of innovation. This was our colleagues Jim Atterbuck and Bill Abernathy trying to give a more dynamic perspective. Things start with a radical product innovation that attracts new entrants to the sector. They have different designs which are in competition. Process innovations then become more important. And then eventually things settle down around a dominant design, the QWERTY keyboard, the Model T, Ford, Hoover, Boeing 747, and so on. So that particular graph, or two sets of graphs, here's the product innovation one, initially more important, and then subsequently the process innovation one takes over. But then to complicate matters, Barros pointed out in the service sector, maybe things work the opposite way around. Start off with process improvements, then you get process innovations, and only at a later stage still do you get more radical product innovations coming in. From one innovation process to several sector-specific types. So by the mid-80s, after 20 years of the studies, we were getting quite a rich picture, but often conflicting results. And it was clear that things were varying with sector. So along comes Keith Pavitt at Sprue with his famous taxonomy. He finds that if you sort firms into these four types of sectors, then that clears up a lot of the earlier differences in empirical findings as to the relevant importance of science push and demand pull, or product versus process innovation. Again, a very highly cited paper from the earlier days. Next, from neoclassical to evolutionary economics. In 1977, Nelson and Winter went looking for a useful theory of innovation, and they scanned the economic literature and concluded they weren't going to find one. So they came back 5 years later with their own one, an evolutionary theory of economic change. That book is the most single, highly cited publication in our field. It has the same number of citations as other citation classics from people like Michael Porter and Williamson. A number of components to the argument. Technological change and innovation are central, generating variation in the form of new products and services. Firms then compete with those new products and services, and the market provides some form of selection mechanism. How firms develop those new products and services is strongly influenced by operating routines within the company. So that forms a form of self-replication mechanism. So immediately you see the similarity here with biological evolution and survival of the fittest. From old to new growth theory. From 1956, we had a neoclassical economic growth theory. The only problem was it couldn't explain the rate of growth. It depended on exogenous factors, in particular, rate of technological change. And along eventually came Paul Romer in the late 1980s to sort this out with a new growth theory. He was actually outside our field, but he drew heavily on contributions from people within the field, such as Paul David, Brian Arthur, and Adam Jaffe. And in his new growth theory, education and R&D were seen as important ways of boosting growth, as were other ways to encourage innovation, such as patents. So all of this pointed to the importance of investing in intangibles, not just in capital goods. From the optimizing firm to the resource-based view of the firm, this is theories of the firm. According to neoclassical economists, firms are optimizing or maximizing organizations armed with perfect information and perfect rationality. And as soon as you say that, you think, well, that's not quite right. Around the 1980s, though, an alternative theory of the firm began to emerge, the resource-based view of the firm. Firms should be seen as a collection of resources, a mixture of human, physical, but other things, brand names, skilled personnel, efficient procedures, and so on. And that work then spawned a whole stream of highly cited publications focusing on things like core competences, learning organization, learning myopia, core rigidities, dynamic capabilities. Famous phrases now in our field all have come from that resource-based view of the firm. In the last 20 years, though, arguably the most important conceptual advance is the shift from individual actors to systems of innovation. In the past, the focus of our analysis was on individual organizations, companies, government labs, universities. Chris Freeman, though, in trying to explain the success of Japan in the 60s and 70s, realized that that was not sufficient. You had to consider the wider system and the links between the different components. And he came up with the system, the national system of innovation as a concept, subsequently expanded by Lundvall and Nelson. There's a definition: those institutions which contribute to the development and diffusion of new technologies and provide the framework in which government policies can influence the innovation process. But the key message here is how effectively a system operates depends not so much on the strength of the individual actors, companies, government labs, universities, and so on, as on the strength of the links between them. And that, as we shall see, has very important policy implications. In particular, it led to the shift in the rationale as to why governments should be intervening in technology and innovation, away from the market failure argument and onto the system failure argument. The role of governments is to overcome failures in the system, to develop new links or strengthen existing links between actors in the system of innovation through things like networks, collaboration, strategic alliances, and so on. From one to two phases of R&D, this relates to the question, why do firms do research and development? The traditional reason was the first one, to develop new knowledge internally. That's the obvious one. But in 89 and 90, Cohen and Leventhal said there is actually a second reason. They do it so that they are in a position to identify potentially useful knowledge generated out there, which they can quickly access, absorb, and exploit. And they came up with this concept of absorptive capacity, and the paper that did that is one of the most highly cited journal articles in recent years. From mode one to mode two, well, this is Mike Gibbons, who had taken over as director of Sprue in 1993, with a number of colleagues came up with this famous book in 94, The New Production of Knowledge, in which they contrasted mode one, traditional discipline-based knowledge production, largely in universities, primarily concerned with furthering knowledge, with mode two, multi or what they call transdisciplinary, in a variety of institutions, pursuing knowledge in the context of application and subject to external accountability. And they argued, somewhat controversially, that perhaps we were witnessing a shift from mode one to mode two. Some historians of science and technology argued there was no evidence for that, but this was quite an influential piece of work. From single technology to multi-technology firms, by now it's becoming clear that many major innovations involve bringing together previously separate streams of technology, fusing them together. And Perry Patel and Keith Pavitt from Sprue and a colleague, Ove Gramstrand, produced a paper showing that technological diversity is increasingly important to innovation and that in some sectors in particular, firms need to combine several technologies, and they're often not able to do this on their own. They need, therefore, to form strategic alliances or links with universities. Okay, we're getting towards the end. From national to multi-level systems of innovation. The concept of national systems of innovation was subsequently extended to other dimensions. Some people argued that regional systems of innovation were actually more important, or that sectoral systems in a particular industrial sector were the key thing. Another work went on technological systems. The work on regional systems of innovation by economic geographers and others, including innovation studies people, showed there's a whole host of factors at work here. Work by Richard Florida, for example, showed that regions with more cultural diversity and bohemian lifestyles tend to be more innovative. He subsequently came across to the UK, did a similar study, concluded that Manchester and Brighton were the two cities in the UK with the greatest cultural diversity, and therefore, clearly, these were the two most innovative cities in the country. Our colleagues at Manchester and ourselves here at Sussex quite like this result. And more recently, a shift from closed to open innovation. The argument here is that knowledge required for innovation is becoming more organisationally dispersed. Actually, historically, that's challengeable. I've got a doctoral student saying it was pretty dispersed in the 19th century. But anyway, the argument is the locus of innovation is shifting from within the firm to networks, alliances, etc. And different people have given this phenomenon different names, open innovation, network innovation, and so on. Okay, so those are the 20 things that we've learned in 50 years. So I hope when you go out to this room, you'll remember at least half a dozen of them. Which of them have had an impact on management? Well, six or seven, I think if you push me, I could come up with evidence, have had a significant impact on the management of technology and innovation in the company. Which have had an impact on policy? A rather smaller number. I think I could make a good argument that the systems of innovation and the system failure ones have had a significant impact, but it's harder to find other examples. The one in red, by the way, looked as though it was going to take off when Gordon Brown picked this up in 1994 and talked about post-neoclassical endogenous growth theory and got loudly booed by Michael Heseltine. In fact, I don't think it's had much influence on policy since then. Okay, just to remind you of the flaws of my approach, I've started with highly cited publications. And there's a lot of other work that goes on that is never highly cited, but which nevertheless has a big influence. And here are some examples for SPRU, different types of research. The Response to the Limits to Growth book, which came out in 1973, the SPRU critique had a big influence at the time. Work on indicators, research evaluation and foresight, I'll come to in a minute. I mustn't forget work by other colleagues in SPRU in energy and environmental policy, being supremely important in things like nuclear energy, nuclear decommissioning and so on. The work on technology and development by Jeff Oldham, Martin Bell and colleagues, a major impact in Latin America and in Asia, often through the person of previous or ex-SPRU students who've gone on to be ministers in Korea or senior government officials in Brazil. And last but not least, the work on military technology by Julian Perry Robinson and his Harvard colleagues. Indeed, in terms of what work in SPRU has had most impact in terms of enabling us to sleep in our beds peacefully at night, that's it. The work that Julian and Messelson have done in coming up with the conventions to minimise the risk of chemical and biological warfare, they had a supremely important role in that, which most people don't know about, and which unfortunately is not captured in my methodology on highly cited publications. Okay, now let's move on to things in which I've been more personally involved. And I want to take four or five of these and some of the lessons that come from them. I came to SPRU in 1978 to work on what was called the Big Science Project, which focused on six laboratories, which at that stage accounted for two-thirds of the budget of the largest research council, the Science Research Council. So the question is, what did Britain get out of that? So we had to devise a methodology for assessing contributions to science, to technology, to training and other skills. I want to focus on the first of those, how did we assess the scientific contributions? And this was a combination of two things: indicators, based on numbers of publications and citations and so on, and extensive peer review. And this was one of the first uses of such indicators for evaluation and policy purposes. One of the first to stress that measures like these are merely very imperfect indicators, or partial indicators, they're not perfect measures. One of the first to combine indicators with very extensive peer review. One of the first to use highly cited papers, as I've done here, to try and identify more radical advances in the field. And one of the first to show that peer review, which works well in small science, when you've got hundreds of small groups competing with each other, breaks down in a situation of oligopoly, as you have in big science, where there may be just one or two labs in a particular field. And those were some of the examples from the time. What reaction did we get? Well, as Jeff will tell you, it was pretty hostile. The scientists didn't like it. We were a threat to their autonomy and to peer review. Two directors of two of the labs were particularly hostile. And there was a sceptical reaction from policymakers. What did we learn from that? Innovative science policy research will often be critical. Those who are critical often end up being rather hostile to you. What you need if your message is to get across, and this, if you like, relates to Project Sappho, you need a product champion to help move the ideas across into practice. We were fortunate we found one, Brian Oakley, secretary at the time of the Science Research Council. Open-minded, prepared to listen, such that when he went off to head Britain's ALVI programme to develop IT, he somewhat took a big risk and asked SPRU and Manchester to evaluate that programme as it went along. And that helped then the subsequent adoption of these techniques in a number of agencies. Second piece of work, science indicators. Having looked at institutions, we next decided to focus on nations as a whole. At that time, a lot of discussion, is British science in decline? But not much evidence, just a lot of anecdotes. So beginning in the 1980s, we did a series of studies which showed, on the basis of Britain's share of publications and citations, yes, we were seeing the decline of British science. These studies had a major impact in the House of Lords and on TV. And this time, interestingly, the scientists liked the answer because they knew they could use this to argue for more money. Various other studies, which I won't go into. And then a key event, 1995, as we did in those days, we invited the new chief scientist, Sir Bob May, to SPRU. And he suddenly discovered bibliometric indicators and got very enthusiastic. He became a product champion. Unfortunately, he ignored some of the caveats which we tried to stress. So in 1997, he publishes a paper in Science, forgetting that these data are heavily biased towards English-speaking countries, and says, look, UK, number two in the world, ahead of France and Germany. Therefore, France and Germany are doing something wrong. They're doing too much of their research in separate institutes, not enough in universities like we do in the UK. That left us with a bit of dilemma to criticise or not to criticise. Comparison to government funding. Early 80s, a lot of concern, Britain not spending enough on science. But we didn't have hard data to show that. So we were commissioned by the Advisory Board for the Research Councils to compare things in more detail. This, if you like, was an experiment where we knew the answer before we started. Yes, Britain was spending less. But we had to do better than the official statistics coming out of OECD, which when we examined them closely, we found were subject to a number of political pressures and other technical difficulties which tended to get swept under the carpet. So we came up with our answer in 86. Yes, we are spending significantly less, a couple of hundred million less than equivalent countries in proportion to our size and wealth. Nothing much then happened. We were a bit disappointed. We couldn't see any impact on government. But ABRC came back, this time with the National Science Foundation in the States, for a new, updated and more rigorous study, which we duly carried out. Near the end, my colleague John Irvin went to see the new minister, Robert Jackson, who had a somewhat checkered career. And Robert Jackson told an interesting story. He said, a couple of weeks ago, I, a relatively junior minister, gets called into the cabinet. Cabinet is discussing the science vote, how much money should be given to scientists. And he's allowed to take a small amount of information with him. He's allowed a few minutes by Mrs. Thatcher. So he takes the last table from our first report. In Robert Jackson's words, after he's presented the conclusion, she, and this is his words, she wrinkled her nose, said, that's not very good, is it? We better give them an extra £100 million. When we heard that, we cheered. Suddenly, we had a direct hit. You don't get many direct hits in science policy. Here was a direct hit. But then there was a twist in the tale. Robert Jackson knew we were doing the second study. And he asked John, what were we likely to find? Now, John, as those of you who know him, sometimes had a slight tendency to exaggerate. So he said, well, we're finding the gaps now even bigger. It's £600 or £700 million. Jackson turns to the civil servant in the room. What's the best we could hope for next time round? Civil servant, maybe £100 million. Jackson to Irvin, if you come in saying the gap is £500 or £600 million, I will put my best statisticians to work showing you're wrong. If you come in with a smaller gap, I'll take it and use it to get more money for British science. Moral dilemma, what do we do? But that dilemma is actually present in all science policy research. On the one hand, you have to engage, you have to compromise to a certain extent. You have to do things quickly. They want an answer in 3 months, and you know really you want 2 years. So to what extent do you do that, and to what extent do you stand on your principles of objectivity and integrity? What's the appropriate balance here? We never discuss this, but we all have to make decisions on that. Fourth area, technology foresight. 1983, Cabinet Office and the Advisory Council on Applied Research and Development asked SPRU if we'd like to bid for a study to how to identify exploitable areas of science. So after discussion with Jeff, we agree to bid, we write a proposal. We then have to give it a title, and we think, aha, there was Project Hindsight in the past, looking at the scientific origins of innovations. We're doing the opposite of that. Where will science take us in the future in terms of innovation? So somewhat whimsically, we called it Project Foresight. Subsequently, we realised what we were focusing on was systematic attempts to look into the longer-term future of science, technology, the economy, society, and environment with a view to identifying the areas of strategic research and emerging generic technologies likely to yield the greatest economic and social benefits. That's a bit of a mouthful, so technology foresight became the shorthand for this, and fortunately for us, that has taken off as a term since then. We looked at four countries, bottom line, learn from other countries, especially the world leader, Japan, and launch a small-scale foresight experiment in the UK, back into ACARD and the Cabinet Office. During this time, we then started converting our report into a book, which we decided to call Foresight in Science. We then thought, well, people may not know what foresight is, so I can recall going around the old Mantell building doing some market research with some subtitles. One people liked was Picking the Winners, so we called our book Foresight in Science, Picking the Winners. A few weeks later, we were horrified to learn this was precisely the wrong title. If you wanted to antagonise Mrs. Thatcher, all you had to say was picking the winners. And in the words of civil servants, she would start swinging her handbag and say, it is not the role of government to pick winners. So, wrong title. In addition, focusing on Japan was perhaps a tactical error. Because the critics said, Japan, very different. What works in Japan won't work in the UK. A rather unscientific attitude, but one that you come to expect in science policy circles. And instead, although they accepted the argument, they said, well, maybe we can just wave our hands, leave it to the market, and foresight will magically emerge. It didn't, of course. Later on, the Dutch asked to do a more thorough study, and that one did have an impact. The ministry that commissioned us ended up launching a foresight exercise. Indeed, some other ministry also launched a foresight exercise, so we're delighted with the outcome there. Then in 1992, out of the blue, I get a phone call in my office. Somebody from the Cabinet Office, a relatively junior civil servant. Would Sprue be interested in doing a study on technology foresight? Yes. Would you be interested in listening to the answer this time, was my response. And yet the civil servant said, yes, change in Prime Minister, John Major, change in government ideology, maybe this time we listen. So we did a small project, this time deliberately focusing on Germany and the US, which by now we're getting more interested in foresight. Why did we choose them? Right of centre governments, more decentralised approach to science policy, i.e. just like the UK. And we felt if we could show those countries were doing it, then we were more likely to get sympathy for doing this in the UK. Set out a full range of options, from the most modest to the most ambitious, 60-page report into the Cabinet. And by then, there was a new Office of Science and Technology and a new minister, the first minister of Cabinet rank looking after science for about 30, 40 years, preparing the first white paper on science and technology for about 20 years. And suddenly there was a call along the lines of, well, ministers can't read 60-page reports, they can only read 2 pages, so could we convert this into 2 pages? That took almost as long to write as the 60-page report. Then we were invited in to brief the minister. And I remember going into this room, long table, minister at the end, civil servants from different departments along the side, and the civil servant who'd hired me and myself at one end. 4 or 5 minutes, we delivered the 2-page brief, what is foresight, why is it important, why should Britain do it? At which point, and I hope he's not in the room, William Waldegrave leaned back in his chair and basically said, technology foresight was my idea in the first place. Now, we'd watched, yes, Minister. So you don't say, no, Minister, it wasn't your idea, it was ours. You say, yes, Minister, what a brilliant idea. Have you thought about this? What about doing that? And it worked a treat. And lo and behold, a few months later, white paper comes out, foresight is the centrepiece, and indeed, because Waldegrave wants to make this his big new idea, he's picked the most ambitious of my list of options as the one to go with, which leaves me worried that we're not going to make it, but actually I think we do. Lessons from all of this, be attuned to the political context. Here, as I say, we focused on Germany and US as comparators, not Japan. Go in at the right level. A few years before this, somebody had told me, don't waste your time talking to ministers or permanent secretaries. They're not really the people who do the work. Go in about the level of level 5 civil servants. The person who hired us happened to be a level 5 civil servant. They're the people who do all the work and they're keen to make a name. When you get towards the end, you need to find a product champion. So when Waldegrave said, it's my idea, okay, you're now the product champion. Run with it. Bill Stewart, chief scientist, very effective at chairing the Foresight Programme. So now another lesson, seize the opportunities when they come along. Make the best of your luck by being prepared for those opportunities. And be prepared to take on other roles. I thought I was a researcher focusing on technology foresight, but for 6 years serving on the steering group for this, I was a practitioner helping to design and carry out foresight. Even at times as we went off on what we called the roadshow, talking to local industry, regional government and so on, I felt I was more of a missionary spreading the gospel about foresight. You have to do that if you get the messages across. I'm going to skip over that and come to how things have changed in my own mind. Back in 1978, maybe I was a bit naive, idealistic, science, technology and innovation, a force for good, source of most progress. Policies for science and technology and innovation can therefore help stimulate science, technology and innovation, ensuring that things are taken up quickly and efficiently. And science policy research can feed into those policies, providing useful inputs. So I was assuming here that evidence-based policy was better than the opposite. In other words, I felt that through science policy research, I could perhaps contribute in a small way to making the world a better place. If you like, here, the shades of Archimedes, give me where I can stand and I will move the world. I thought the place to stand was science policy research. Okay, how do I feel 30 years later? Well, I've got a few more reservations. Evidence-based policy. Well, when you go trying to tout this idea, what do you find? Well, actually, policymakers prefer evidence that supports the policy they've already chosen in the first place. So what they're looking for is policy-based evidence, not evidence-based policy. Secondly, benefits of all this should be greater than the costs. Simply stated, not sure it always happens. We stressed this right at the start in our work on research assessment. We said the cost of that should be very much less than the cost of what we're assessing. But switch to something a little bit different but related to this, the research assessment exercise, where you can make an argument that the early exercises had substantial benefits, making us more strategic in relation to our research. But then, almost certainly, diminishing returns set in. At the same time, we were putting more and more effort into these, every university, every department preparing for the next one. So the costs were increasing, and at some point those two curves have to cross over. And Aldo and I, in a paper in 2003, said maybe by about the fourth or fifth exercise that had happened. Third problem or reservation, if you measure a system, you change this. I knew this from physics, but it's also familiar in social sciences. Hawthorne observing workers in factories in the 1920s found just observing them made them work better. Sort of psychological placebo effect, if you like. And then, more worrying, Goodhart's law. Once a performance measure becomes a policy target, then it quickly loses its value for measuring what you're interested in the first place. And there are shades of that by using publication and citation indicators, which we helped to develop. That has unfortunately led to changes in publishing and referencing behaviour. Research assessment exercise, again, led to an element of game playing. And if you ask me, okay, I'm the expert on foresight, make a prediction. I will make a prediction here. 10 years' time, we're about to switch from the research assessment exercise to something called the research evaluation framework, which is going to be based on indicators. My prediction, 10 years' time, we'll all be complaining about the research evaluation framework and comparing it with the good old days of the research assessment exercise. Has some of the things we've done pushed us towards an audit society? Remember, we started all of this with very laudable aims. We were trying to increase the benefits from science and technology to society, to open things up, to generate more accountability, more effective policy. But then, as a victim of all of this, to some extent, I, like many other professionals, feel, well, I'm now subject to much greater demands from policymakers for quality, transparency, accountability, and so on. And that seems to come at some cost to the quality, the nature of what I do. Arguably now there's less autonomy, less trust, less collegiality than 20 or 30 years ago. And last reservation, are the models coming out of our field now too complex? I showed you the early simple models, easy to understand, even for busy policymakers. Since then, remarkable progress. We now have this interactive model that I showed you, embedded in notions of evolutionary economics and systems of innovation. This constitutes what Giovanni Dossi has called the Yale-Stanford-Sussex synthesis. Arguably, this is a sort of proto-paradigm for an emerging discipline here. And what we're seeing here is what goes on in many social sciences. Each new generation of researchers wants to overthrow the previous generation and their models. They criticize them. They come up with their own models. Their own models tend to be more complex. But those more complex models are then more difficult to explain to busy policymakers or managers in industry. So, question, are they still as useful? So I leave you, as the Vice-Chancellor indicated, with some questions. After 50 years of advances in science policy research, is science policy now more effective? I think it is. But do we have hard evidence that evidence-based policy is better? No. There's a problem here. You can't have randomized control trials in the world of policy. You'd need to have a placebo. What would a placebo policy look like? And how would you prevent people knowing they're being subject to it? Actually, once or twice in the last few years, I've wondered whether this is actually going on, but that's another matter. Are the benefits from using the inputs from science policy research greater than the costs and unintended adverse consequences? I believe yes, in general, but occasionally that's not always been the case. Is science now better? I'd be interested from not just scientists, but researchers more generally in this room as to whether they feel things are now better. But I am conscious of the fact whenever I go around the world to conferences, academics from wherever are complaining about their university, their funding agencies, their government policies, and comparing it with the good old days, although I'm not sure whether there were good old days. And is the world a better place? I think it is, but this is a tricky one. I'm reminded of a book which prompted a debate on this in the 1990s. It was called The Risk Society. It argued that science, technology, and innovation was making the world a riskier place, that there were more risks, unintended consequences, social costs to the things we were doing. I think that's wrong. I think what's happening is we're developing more sophisticated antennae for detecting risks. Because if you look at the crude indicators, life expectancy, every year I've been alive, life expectancy has gone up 2.5 months. So during my lifetime, life expectancy has increased by 10 or 11 years. In terms of decreasing poverty, particularly in recent years in China and India, that's certainly an improvement. In terms of quality of life, particularly for women, when I think of the sort of life that women had in the 1950s, like my mother, spending 2 hours it took on average to prepare a meal, spending a whole day washing, that's all now gone largely through to technology and innovation. So I think the world is a better place. I think science policies have contributed partly to that, and in a small, modest way, I think science policy researchers have contributed to that. But I leave that as an open-ended question. Thank you.